WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin. And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinor. We are here today to talk about inequality and the 1% from a British perspective. With us from England is Danny Dorling, the Halford Mackinder Professor in Geography at the University of Oxford. He has worked both with the British government and the World Health Organization and has published more than 25 books, including Injustice, Why Social Inequality Exists, So You Think You Know About Britain, and The 32 Stops. All of them for Penguin Underground Lines. We will be talking mostly about his latest book, Inequality and the 1%. And hello, Danny. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
So before we go into the book and your expertise, it is important to look at England, I think, not just because it is another Western country with a lot of wealth and not just because it has dealt, like the United States, with people with prime ministers of various stripes, including, of course, Margaret Thatcher. But because it is, London is, isn't it, the center, so as not to say the heart of the financial world, isn't it?
It is. London is maybe a fraction more powerful than New York, simply because of where it is based. It is nearer the middle of the financial world, and money flows around London. London is very, very closely connected to the United States, though. We have an enormous number of bankers who fly across the Atlantic between New York and between London. So London is, if you like, in some ways an American base within Europe. And a lot of the banks in London are American banks. But these two countries, the UK and the USA, are very similar to each other when it comes to inequality, and very different from most of the other rich countries of the world, which almost all are much more equal than we are.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that London is an American base, that's very interesting. I have not heard that before.
I can give you one example.
Yeah, please.
The European Bank surveys the salaries of top bankers in Europe. The highest number of bankers who are paid over €1 million in the equivalent money, well, it's not far off $1 million a year, are in London. 2,200 bankers are paid over $1 million a year in London. The next highest number in Europe is about 197 in Germany. Huh. So in the rest of Europe, bankers and financiers are not paid anything like the amount of money that they're paid in the UK. And the way that they argue for having such a high salary in the UK is they look at the salary of bankers in New York and they say, look, these American salaries are high. I could get a job working in a bank in New York, so I need to be paid this much in London. But the rest of Europe doesn't tolerate people being paid as much as that.
So one thing that's really interesting about what you just said is that it shows us that it's not a necessity to pay bankers huge amounts of money. They work in Germany, they work in Norway, they work all over the world, and they don't necessarily get paid that much.
No, it's incredible. And in fact, bankers have got very few places to go where they will be paid this much. So when they say, if you pay me less, I'll leave, they can only actually work in London and New York and be paid that much. Nobody else will pay them that much. Switzerland is a banking center. Bankers in Switzerland are paid about half as much as bankers in London. And this means that the whole of the top 1%, the best off-paid people in Switzerland, receive about half as much income per year than the best off 1% in the UK. And the Swiss banking system works very well. If anything, it worked slightly better than the London banking system in 2008 with the economic crash. In Japan, bankers are paid even less. And Japan did very well throughout the economic recession we've had recently. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no need to pay these people $1 million or $2 million or $3 million or pounds a year. almost nobody else does apart from people in the UK and people in the USA.
So,
and we don't understand that because we think other countries pay their bankers a lot, and we don't know that they do not do this.
So why are we? Why? I mean, I think it's one. It's a very prevalent myth here in the United States, anyway, that you have to pay them. You have to pay them these huge amounts so that they don't leave. Because if they leave, God knows what happens. But we know that what happens while they work at these ridiculous salaries is really quite destructive to the rest of us.
It's not good. And of course, the only place they could go would be London. There are only 2,200 jobs paid this much. So the only way they could get these very high-paid jobs in London is if British bankers were willing to leave their very high-paid jobs for your American bankers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not willing to do that. There isn't that much. You know, there are a few people, like Bob Diamond, the former head of Barclays Bank, who was the highest-paid person in Britain until he had to go because of what happened at Barclays, and he's gone back over to America. But there are not actually that many who do move. And if they do move, they're moving between those two cities. But these two cities have managed to create a myth that there is a world market for what they call talent. They call themselves talent.
Yeah.
And they're in demand all over the world, and they could get these salaries in many places. And they do not like it when people actually look at the data and discover that it is only them. And in fact, of course, they're at the center of some of the banks that failed the most in the world economy. These banks did very, very badly. They behaved very, very badly. But the salaries of people at the top did not come down very much as a result. And it is primarily because of finance that the 1% are paid so much, because over 90% of people in the top 1% are men and they're working in finance and management. Only 3% of the 1%, only 3% of the very best off 1% of people in the United States and the United Kingdom are working in sport or as a singer or as a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
97% are not, and of that 97%, 90% are in banking and finance. This is driving inequality in our two countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty much every sentence that you say raises more questions. So let's start with that. The designation of talent, I think that people like Diamond, and by the way, it's interesting that at least two of them have last names that sound like Diamond, isn't it? But
we had one called Richie. His name was Rich. Anyway, carry on, sorry.
That's very interesting. So, they call themselves talent, and I think they do have at least one very distinct talent, which is making themselves extremely rich and also having that Teflon touch that they can, while making themselves very rich, they can destroy really the world's economy. They can destroy the lives of very many people, but nothing happens to them. So I think that is somewhat of a talent. So if you want to talk about the kind of personality that has this talent, and go ahead, start with that.
I mean, in a way, I'd like to start off by saying it isn't their fault. There are people in every country of the world who are greedy, and if you allow them to be greedy, will try to amass as much money as they can, and if you don't control them, this is what you'll get. In all other rich countries in the world, their societies are well organized enough not to allow people to get into this position who might be greedy. So it really is our collective fault in the UK and the USA that we have allowed and continue to allow and even encourage this to happen. The kinds of people who get to the top are much more single-minded. They often find it hard to be what is called pro-social, to have ideas about how things may seem from other people's shoes. They are predominantly male. Very few women get up to the top. They will, of course, have likely had advantages in life, so they're more likely to be white than to be black and so on, but not always. What is much more prevalent in their background is evidence that they are willing to step over other people, to step on other people's necks, if you like, to get promoted. They are more callous, less worried about what others might think about how they behave, although, of course, they do not want to go to prison if they do something illegal, so they find ways of avoiding that. And one of the saddest things about this group, Robert Peston, the former economics editor of the BBC and the business editor before then, Robert Peston wrote a book a few years ago in which he looked at the lives of many people at the top of this group in Britain, and he found that very often something had gone terribly wrong when they were a child. That somebody had died, they had had some other disaster, and that is much more prevalent in the lives of top financiers than it is in everybody else, which is part of the reason for me saying, although we often do not like these people and we do not like what they have done, it is also our collective fault that we have allowed people to get into this situation. I mean, we tell young men that they should try to get a job in finance, they should try to get to Manhattan, or they should try to get to London. We tell them that getting a good salary shows what a great person you are. And we have societies which say if you can afford a big car, if you can afford an expensive apartment, you have achieved and exceeded. So we are kind of egging people on to do this. And we need, I think, to stop saying that this is a very impressive thing to do and stop spreading the myth where we tell these people that there are only a few people with incredible brains who can run banks and you are worth so much because you are so special. Because it's a lie, and it damages them because some of them come to believe it and come to believe that, you know, somehow above all other kinds of human beings, above doctors who can keep people alive, above artists, above painters, above everybody else, somehow the top heights of humanity is to become a banker. You know, this is a ridiculous situation to have got into.
So I think what I hear from you is that you could call it personal exceptionalism, right? A person who thinks that he is right, he's perfect, he is he deserves the things that often were handed to him with a silver spoon, and that seems to mesh to me with American exceptionalism, with British exceptionalism, with, let me take it as far as British colonialism and America's feeling that its role to be the police, the policeman of the world. Does that make sense? I mean, because I'm trying to understand still why it is that we allow that in these two countries. Do you see this connection?
When you look at the richest 25 countries in the world, which are the ones that I compare, there are excuses as to why the UK and the USA do sit within the top four. The other two, by the way, are Singapore, which is a tiny, very small, unequal city state, and Israel, which is a very unequal country.
Yeah.
Those two are much smaller. The UK was the world power before the USA, and several things happen when you are a world power. One is that you manage to accrue a lot more money and wealth than other countries because you control trade and markets, and people have to buy your goods that you produce in your factories. So the UK became far more richer than other countries in Europe. And that those riches allowed the people at the top of society to have more without the people at the bottom having to be absolutely destitute. The same thing has happened in the United States, particularly in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. Having such control of world markets, having such dominance in, you know, everything from Coca-Cola to computers, meant the United States had money flooding into it, and that makes it easier to have people at the top of society who are paid far more. In other countries, I mean, the most equal country in the rich world is Japan. One of the other most equal is Germany. The act of losing a war, of not being a world power, was one of the reasons why they don't have the inequalities we have. In Japan, after 1945, the Americans decided to take the land off the aristocracy in Japan and to redistribute it because they were afraid of a communist revolution. And America created the most equal rich country in the world, which is why in Japan there is hardly anybody paid the salaries that bankers in London and New York are paid. In Germany, the Marshall Plan meant that every city was given a function, and the division of Germany east and west stopped Berlin becoming very powerful, and you end up with a much more equitable country. And also, of course, but by losing the war, the people at the top of society are no longer in control a generation later. This isn't the same in the UK and the USA. In the USA, in many ways, the people at the top of society are very similar to the people who are at the top of society a generation ago and a generation before them and so on. And it isn't that different in the USA, even though there's a dislike of inherited wealth and the idea that you should supposedly make your money by yourself. When you look at people at the top of business, you know, you look at somebody like Bill Gates, you find that Bill Gates Sr., his dad, I think, had the same name, was hardly poor. Mm-hmm. So you have similar things going on. But also, because both of these countries have not suffered invasion, have not had an equalizing moment, there is a long legacy of seeing inequalities as being justified, of the nature of our societies not being questioned. And we have unusual prejudices which other countries do not have as badly as we have. Famously, the United Kingdom, where I live, has a class system and a class structure. And people are looked down upon if they are lower class. Mm-hmm. And famously, in the United States, a degree of racism and the behavior is higher than it is in other richer countries. And I think these two things, the way in which we treat people differently by social class in the UK and the way in which people are treated differently by race in the USA, are connected to our tolerance of inequality. Because in more equal rich countries, it is much harder to sustain racism and it is much harder to sustain prejudice by social class because people are paid the same amount or very similar to you. And when you're paid the same amount, it means you're respecting each other. And when you begin to respect each other, it is difficult to keep other prejudices alive. The same happens when men and women are paid the same amount. When men and women are paid the same amount, it is difficult to sustain sexist attitudes about women. It is much easier when you pay women far less than men to see women as inferior to men. And mm-hmm. I think these kind of things are going on in these two countries.
Mm-hmm. The numbers here are 256-2001, 1-866-899-WORT. Should you want to join this fascinating, I think, conversation, you can also join us on social media at War Talk on Twitter or A Public Affair on Facebook. And again, urging you, if you have something to say, to call us, not at the last minute. My guest is Danny Dorling. He's the Halford Mackinder. I hope I'm saying it correctly.
You are.
Okay. Professor in geography at the University of Oxford. He has published more than 25 books, and we are talking about his work on inequality. So I'm assuming you recognize that I have an accent that is not American, Danny. I'm actually from Israel, and I was surprised to hear that Israel is in that... well, not really surprised. When I go there nowadays, the level of inequality just screams in your face. There's no question about that. Since the Likud came to power many years ago...
But this statistic for Israel includes Gaza and the West Bank.
Aha, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah,
that is one of the things that I was wondering. And I think that, again, as we're looking at the big picture, inequality has grown as just blatant racism and blatant... attacks and taking of land and so on have become so common in Israel, which I mean, you know, I think Israel has always been a racist country and there were always attacks on Palestinians, but what's going on now really wasn't at all evident as I at the time that I was growing up. So talk if you will about that connection again in that specific example.
It's really interesting to, I mean, it came as a shock to me to see that the UK, if you look at the income of the best off 10th compared to the worst off 10th, in the UK it is slightly worse than Israel, and that includes all the difficulties that you know exist in Israel. In all these countries at the top of this inequality league table, there are big problems. The other one is Singapore, where there is prejudice between the Chinese and Malay communities, where there are lots of servants in Singapore who are brought in but are not allowed to have children and are deported if they cause any trouble and are paid very little.
Wow.
So Singapore is another country. But in a way, I suppose one thing the statistics show is that although, you know, when we look at Israel and we see the news reports about Israel, we often think of Israel as being very exceptional. It actually fits within this group of four countries. It is not unusually unequal when it comes to economic differences. Compared to the USA and the UK and Singapore, Israel is in that group. The way that inequalities are expressed in the UK is much more subtle. So, for instance, people are losing land in the UK, but they're losing it because increasingly more and more of our population are having to rent from a private landlord because they are unable to get a house either from the government or get a mortgage and begin to buy a house themselves. So a small group of very rich people in Britain are buying up more and more of the land. Now, obviously, it is much less violent and much less obvious than what happens in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the ownership of wealth and the income you get from being a landlord and how much money you lose if you have to be a tenant to a private landlord rather than a tenant to a charity or to the government, or able to buy the house you live in, this all increases inequalities. And I think it's interesting to put these four countries together and to say, you know, What is similar about these four countries, about Singapore, Israel, the United States and the UK, and then have a look at the four countries in the rich world with the greatest levels of equality, and they are Japan, Finland, Sweden and Norway. And if you look at life in Japan, Sweden, Finland and Norway, you'll see that people have very similar experiences in terms of the types of school they go to. Very few people are in prison in any of these countries. The rates of crime are very, very low. Children do very well at university. Jobs are generally well paid, particularly jobs at the bottom. Cleaners and people who are washing up dishes in restaurants and so on are remarkably well paid in these countries. But the rich in these countries, and of course there were always people who are rich everywhere, the rich do not appear to be particularly unhappy. They don't have as much money as the rich in the unequal countries, but they're not deciding to leave Scandinavia or to leave Japan. It isn't a terrible place to be rich. They are mixing far more with other people. So social attitudes are very different to people in Japan. And if I could just give you one example I think really brings it home.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the reaction to natural disasters.
Yes.
There was recently a natural disaster in Japan, a terrible natural disaster, which was a tsunami. And the tsunami killed many people. In the wake of the tsunami, the Japanese society mobilized itself and got aid to that part of the coast, which was inundated with water, as fast as it could. I was in Japan a few weeks after the tsunami hit, and I was at the offices of the census in Tokyo. And they were taking their buildings, their temporary buildings, down and putting them in lorries so they could drive the buildings to the area to give people somewhere to sleep. Nobody had told them to do it. They just decided to do it because they saw other Japanese people as like them, people who they'd never met. Now compare that to how the United States dealt with Hurricane Katrina.
Yes.
And what happened in the wake of Katrina. And did people treat other people as if they were like them? Or did the government send in the National Guard and people with guns and helicopters?
Mm-hmm.
And it's shocking to compare these two countries and a similar national disaster and what happens in terms of flooding and how people treat each other in a much more equal country when the levels of pay are much more similar and when wealth is much more similar. People trust other people and empathize with them far more and are willing to help them far more in an unequal country, we begin to fear each other. We get very, very frightened of each other. We begin to see each other as different, because it's quite hard to carry on living in an unequal country if you see other people as just as deserving as you, because then you have to question, well, why am I being paid this much when somebody else is being paid so much less, but we're still both working 8 or 10 hours a day? And I do think these things get to the heart of many problems in our societies and help explain why some of us have our prisons so full of people. I mean, there are millions of people in prison in the United States.
Yep.
Whereas in other countries, hardly anybody is in a prison because the level of crime being committed is so much lower. And it is almost always in the more equal economic countries where crime rates are low, where children do better at school, where divorce rates are lower, where rates of mental illness are far, far lower in more equal countries and far higher in more unequal countries.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't recognize that you cannot run a happy society which is also economically unequal, where you let the best off 1% have such a large slice of the cake, it's 15% of the cake in the UK, it's 20% in the USA. You cannot have a happy, content, safe society if you tolerate these extremely high rates of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the importance of this is only just being realized, because it's only been in the last 20 or 30 years that these differences between societies have grown so wide that inequality in the US and the UK has increased so much that we can actually now begin to see the effect of that and what happens when you allow this to occur. So we have a natural experiment. Unfortunately, if we live in the USA or the UK, we are the ones in the part of the experiment which is the part you wouldn't necessarily have chosen to be in if you had known beforehand what was going to happen.
Right, and it's actually, it's interesting that you phrase it like that, because, you know, I kind of ended up in the United States by fate or chance or whatever, you know. It wasn't, I didn't really choose to be here. I was sent here for work, and then, you know, met a guy and got married and,
yeah,
and ended up here. And I often, especially nowadays here in Wisconsin, looking at Governor Walker and his posse taking away from us everything that we have and establishing corruption in government and selling every pristine part of the state and taking away my salary for the second time this June and taking, you know, making it so that our pension are going to be smaller. And I wonder why, you know, of all the places I could have ended up, why
Well, it could have. It's, on the other hand, you are still, despite what the governor is doing, you're still in one of the more equal states in the USA.
Really?
It is. Yes, there's a book called The Spirit Level, which has a series of graphs which compares the different states in the USA and finds that, you know, down in Alabama and so on, where the rates of inequality are highest, life is hardest for everybody on average. On the other hand, had you gone to Finland in the recent economic recession worldwide,
mm-hmm,
in Finland they decided to increase taxation and public spending so that nobody's pension had to be cut.
Mm-hmm.
And no, you know, and Finland now has the highest public expenditure in Europe, but it also has schools, state schools, which 99% of the population go to in Finland, and they get the very highest exam results when tested on
mm-hmm
the planet.
Yeah,
and that is provided for everybody by everybody. But in a sense, when you're a small country like Finland, and maybe particularly small countries with their own languages, like Denmark and the Netherlands, which are similar, it may be easier to see other people as like you when you are different from people in the rest of the world. And another problem that the UK and the USA have could be the English language,
mm-hmm,
in that we are not that different from other people in the world because so many other people in the world speak our language. Other unequal countries, not quite as unequal as us, but, you know, Canada, Australia and New Zealand are more unequal than average. We may also be more susceptible to advertising and other things. It is easier,
right,
to produce advertising in English, whereas it costs a bit more to translate it. So there are numerous things going on. But I think the most important thing, I think, which can help you be optimistic, is this hasn't always been the case. In the 1960s and 70s, the United States was a much more equal place than it is now. The United Kingdom was a much more equal place than it is now. It really was only after Margaret Thatcher was elected in 1979 and Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980 that we began to increase inequalities. The problem is we carried on increasing them all the way through the 80s and the 90s and the noughties, and you know, only just now the inequality rise may be stopping now. We're not sure, but we're just seeing it begin to wobble. So it is possible that next year, for the first time, we might see the 1% in the United States taking slightly less of the cake. And again, in the UK, we might just about see it happen. And it's partly because people are beginning to become aware of just how much is being taken by such a small group of people whose parents didn't take as much. This is new. You can go back to the great-grandparents. You can go back to the Jazz Age and 1920s and 1910, and you can find inequalities as big as this again, when people had servants in large numbers and people had huge houses in the countryside. But you have to go back in time that far to find a situation where inequalities between us are as wide as they are now. So it is unusual. We've allowed it to grow up. We were told that if we let the rich become richer, it would benefit the rest of us because the money would somehow trickle down and cascade down and spread out. And we allow people the benefit of the doubt. We let them try it to see if it would happen. And it's failed.
Yeah.
One problem, though, is that people who have got a lot of money don't want to admit it's failed, because the implications of admitting it's failed are that they shouldn't have as much money, because by having so much money, they're not actually helping the rest of us. In the UK, everybody below the 1% has seen a cut in their average income in the last 5 years, and actually a slight equalisation in that the 99% have come together slightly, but the 1%, people earning over £160,000 or £200,000 a year for a couple, the 1% have seen their incomes rise. They've moved away, and at the very top of the 1%, if you look at the richest 1,000 families in the UK, they have doubled their wealth in the last 5 years. And that is truly shocking in a country where most people are now worse off than they were 5 years ago. Watch the very rich is doubling their wealth. And this division, the 1% moving away from the rest of the 99%, this has only happened since 2008. For the entire century before 2008, the 1% travelled with the 10% beneath them. The rich and the not-so-rich travelled together. But since 2008, the 1% have moved away, and the people just beneath them, the pretty well-off, haven't hung on to their coattails anymore. And that's politically very, very interesting, because it's very hard to carry on running a country when telling people that something works when it isn't even working for people who are, you know, not very far beneath the very rich.
Yeah, and I hope we get to talk about Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders, but I do have a couple people waiting on the line to talk to you, so we'll get to the phones, 256-2011-866. 899-WORT. Again, our guest is Danny Dorling. He is a professor of geography at the University of Oxford in England. And hello, Randy, you on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Boy, this wasn't what I thought geography handled. I found it's very intriguing. And I have two questions, if I can. Some time ago, you were talking about how the rich just think differently. And that jives my real view. I've always quoted F. Scott Fitzgerald, said the rich are not like you and me. Deep down in their heart, they know they're better. But he's a writer, and I'm wondering if you as a social scientist have data that supports that.
Thank you. Danny.
Okay, on that, it's only recently that geographers have begun to look at this, but this is geographical comparisons. We are comparing different countries, so we have geographical data which suggests that these things work. When it is very hard to study the 1% because they're quite a secretive group, so you can't find out what the 1% think by surveying them, because they will not fill in the surveys. What people have done is observe the behavior of people in the top 1%. And one interesting thing to see is that people who are very well off often don't look at other people like average people. They will walk past you when they go to the restaurant. They won't make eye contact with you. And the disconcerting thing is to be told the way that the people at the top of society are behaving to you, an average person in society, is very similar to how many of us behave to the homeless. We tend not to look at the homeless. We tend to avoid eye contact with the homeless. We also do the same with people who come into our offices to clean them. So it's late at night now in the United Kingdom. I'm in my office at work. At some point, the man who empties my bin will come in. Normally, when the man who empties your bin comes in, you don't really acknowledge them and so on. So when you ask about the 1% thinking differently, they think about average people in a way that average people think about people at the very bottom of society. And in a way, you can let them off how they behave because we behave like it too. But they won't behave like it, and they didn't. They stopped behaving like it in the 60s and 70s when they weren't that different. And also, when you don't have people who are homeless and you don't have people at the bottom of society, when you pay the people who clean your offices twice as much, which is what they do in Scandinavia and Finland, you begin to treat them differently. But a lot of this evidence is anecdotal. We're not allowed to wire up the 1% to machines and measure their brainwaves. They're not particularly willing to allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's
can I ask my second question?
Go ahead.
All right. The other thing is that when you were talking about the countries, the developed countries that are more equal versus those that are less, there seems to be a little bit of a correlation between racial homogeneity. In other words, it seems like the countries that have a high single race or single nationality population tend to be more equal than those that are much more diverse.
It's correct and it's interesting, but the question is why. There are at least two things going on. One is that you have a high rate of immigration in general to unequal countries because there are lots of jobs at the bottom and there are lots of spaces at the very top. So famously, the United States has a high rate of immigration from Mexico and from other countries because there are lots of jobs for people who come from Mexico to do. I spent some time in California, in Santa Barbara, and I was amazed to watch during the day people from Mexico arrive and clean the houses of the people who lived, and then they would go down the hill again. So unequal countries have lots of space at the bottom, which brings in people who are often ethnically different from many of the people who are there, but also at the very top. So in the UK, the Queen used to be one of the richest people in the UK, but she's now about number 70, and most of the people who've come into the UK who are richer than her are not white. They're of various different ethnicities. So a very unequal country has space for this. But the other thing, which is even more interesting, is that in countries which are now more equal, they often did have bigger racial inequalities in the past. But when people are paid the same amount of money, they mix. So you see ethnic inequalities disappear because people marry. They have children with each other and the differences go. The most extreme case is Iceland. Iceland's a very equal little country. And people often talk about the Icelandic people as if they're a single race of some kind. But we have the genome of the Icelandic people, so you can see where they come from. And essentially, there are two groups in Iceland. There are the Vikings, and then there are the Celtic slaves that the Vikings brought back to Iceland. So this was a slave and master society in Iceland. But people have mixed so much that there is no common memory of the fact that people were slaves and not slaves in Iceland. Similarly in Japan. In Japan, people now talk about a single group who are Japanese. But if you look at the 1920s and 30s in Japan, people talked about very different groups. And if you actually look at people in Japan, they can look very differently, but people don't look different to each other when they're paid the same. Or you can look at Finland or Sweden, which is a better example, or Norway. There is now a pretty high rate of immigration into these countries because these countries have opened up their doors to Syria and to other refugees and to people from parts of Africa. But there are not terrible difficulties with racism in those countries, anything like the kind of difficulties you get in the United States because of the attitudes to people of people have in those countries. And my prediction will be that you'll get a very high rate of mixing. In the Scandinavian countries, people will marry each other, they will have children with each other, because it is easier to mix socially when you're not economically separated. Our children do not play with people who are much richer or much poorer than them. And this is one thing we don't tend to notice very much, because we live in different neighbourhoods. We live in rich neighbourhoods, average neighbourhoods and poor neighbourhoods, and we have different schools. And some children go to university and others don't. And the universities are even ordered by whether they're universities for wealthy children or universities for average children. We reduce the amount of mixing in society. And then that leads to people saying, oh, it's because we don't mix that we're unequal. Whereas it's the other way around. It's because we tolerate inequality that we see less mixing.
Mm-hmm. It's a vicious circle, basically. Thank you, Randy. Let's go to Walt. Hi, Walt. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I wonder if your guest could point out places or organizations where the pursuit of equality, especially regarding equal pay for women, has either been set as a goal or actually been accomplished, both worldwide and in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Danny Doran.
Okay, I find it hard to do it in the United States. you will... Now, this is interesting... This is led by Scandinavia. In Scandinavia, the biggest achievements are done on pay of women and pay of men. In Sweden, income is actually something which is a public piece of information, so you can see what people's income is and how much tax they've paid, which is a great way of making sure people pay tax, because you can check your neighbor's tax records and see if they're not doing it. The Scandinavian countries have moved the closest, but there's still a gap between men and women's pay. In the United Kingdom, we've had some progress, but very small. Interestingly, Japan, there is still inequality there. Everything doesn't always line up in the same way. There's a higher rate of sexism in Japan than there is in Scandinavia, despite Japan being a more equal country. However, and nobody really knows the reason why, women in Japan live on average 8 years longer than men. Not everything is going badly for women. It's an eight-year difference. And Japanese men don't have to feel too bad, because they still have the highest life expectancy in the world. People live longer lives in more equal countries. They also, and this is particularly important, infant mortality is half in the equal countries as compared to the United States. And if you think about infant mortality as being the kind of a measure of what was happening to young women who are about to become mothers, you can see that young women are not doing so well in the United States as compared to young women in more equal countries. And we have numerous more statistics that the rate at which young women are being evicted from properties in the United States is shocking compared to any other country. And this has all kinds of effects on what kind of pay people can get, what kind of jobs they can hold on to, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And we have another caller, and probably time for another caller or two if you call right now at 256-2001, 1-866-899-WORT. Again, you can join us also on social media. Mike, you're on the air.
Thank you. What really lit my fire is when you talk about these people that have a lot of money, and they walk by people like us who are people that are reasonably okay, I guess, doing, and they can't even look at them at the eye. It's like they're homeless. And these rich people are the ones that are causing the most damage to our environment, mm-hmm. by far, with all the jet flying and the factory pollution, global warming. And the people that don't have money aren't doing hardly any damage at all. And I have a proposal on my blog site that would even the score. It's called allthingsenvironmental.com. And I've been pushing this at the state level here until I retired. And I've been calling WPR. Wisconsin Public Radio has these tourists travel out to exotic locations. The greenhouse gases from all that kind of traveling is terrible.
And so thanks, Mike. And I want to bring up the title of your first chapter in the book, Inequality and the 1%. Can we afford the super rich?
Yes.
Can
it's
we?
Tricky to do. Mike is very, very right with the environmental damage. If everybody in the world behaved like people in the United States behave, we would need four planets. Mm-hmm. If they behaved like they behave in Japan, we need two. Now, unfortunately, that's still one more planet than we have, but it shows that the Japanese are consuming and polluting per person half as much as the Americans. In Europe, 50% of business flights are from passengers, businessmen largely, who are just 3% of the population. So most of the pollution you see is a tiny number. But one thing I thought was very telling recently was somebody did a survey of these business travelers, and they're not very happy. They get jet lag. They have other medical problems from sitting on these planes. But they do create the most pollution. They do buy the most numbers of things that they do not need. They're most likely to have the largest cars, and they're most likely to, you know, have multiple homes and so on and so on. If we want a planet in which people pollute less, you need to have more equal societies, not just so that you don't have a group of rich people who are polluting a lot, but average members of society consume less and are happier with less if the people above them have less. I'll give you one last example, which is meat and hamburgers. In the United States, people eat the most meat in the rich countries of the world per head. It is not the rich eating all the meat, because the rich would actually die if they ate all the meat, because you can't eat, you know, eating too much meat is really bad for you. So the average American eats more meat, but the person above them is eating a lot. In the United Kingdom, we eat a third less meat than the United States, because we are a more equal country than you, not much, but enough. But in Japan, and this includes fish as well, they eat half as much. There's a almost perfect correlation between obesity and inequality. Huh. Obesity rates are the highest in the most unequal countries. People get fatter, they eat more on average. People are thinner in more equal countries. And it isn't just because people eat more, it's also because of transport systems. So in the United States, only 3.5% of the population cycle or walk to work because they have to drive. And if you sit in a car driving, not only do you pollute the planet and you're admitting more fumes from the exhaust of your car, but you're not exercising. You're sitting there just exercising your foot. Whereas if you look at more equal countries where there's more opportunity to walk and cycle because work and home are built near to each other, where there are more trains and fewer cars, so people walk more to get to the train station, they don't just drive their car up to their office and do the shortest walk possible, people get more exercise and they're healthier in more equal countries. It isn't that this explained everything, and of course it isn't one thing determining the other, but it is stunning to see so many things correlated in this way. If you want to save the planet, if you want to have less consumption, if you want to have people being happy, if you don't want people trapped in cars in an individualistic society, you have to begin to seriously take the idea of reducing economic inequalities, because it goes with all those other things.
Mm-hmm. So I have about 500 more questions for you and only about 6 minutes. So first of all, I hope we can call on you again, because the conversation really is not going to end today. Yes?
Yes, thank you very much. I'd love to do that again.
Great, thank you. And let me ask you then my last two questions for today, so that hopefully we can get in some depth to each of them. So as I mentioned earlier, we have somewhat of a phenomenon, right? We have Jeremy Corbyn winning the Labour candidacy in the UK. We have Bernie Sanders not having won anything yet except the public excitement, thousands and thousands of people coming to see him wherever he is, even though the mainstream media either don't talk about him or talk about him as someone who has no chance. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that. And then also, you mentioned Iceland a number of times, and if I'm not mistaken, Iceland has actually imprisoned some of the bankers.
Yes.
Yeah, and so talk about that too, if you will, That would be probably a good note to end on today.
End on, okay. There are amazing things going on around the world. Yes, only in a few cases are bankers being imprisoned, but the rules on banking are being tightened up, at least across the whole of Europe, and we're beginning to see some restraint on the pay. So the very highest paid bankers a few years ago, nobody has paid as much as they were paid now. It's only just started, but that's beginning to happen. In terms of politics, of course, there's a series of countries in Europe, in Spain and Italy and Greece, where new political parties have begun and are doing quite amazing things. Not always getting everything right, because they're new, they have no track record, but it is interesting. In other countries in Europe, the standard thing that happened since 2008 is whoever was in power in 2008, you voted them out because you were very angry about what had just happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we vote out the next group who tend to lose because they can't sort out the problem. But as you say, you've got Saunders there. We've got Jeremy Corbyn here. Both of the men you would have never expected to get anywhere near power until recently. Jeremy Corbyn's camp is still shocked that they managed to get him nominated to stand, because he had to get a certain number of MPs to agree to nominate him. What happened is that thousands and thousands of people registered to vote and join the Labour Party. I think the size of that political party doubled in just a matter of months, and there was an overwhelming victory for somebody who was saying something very different to what the other candidates were saying, and that's having an effect on British politics. It's becoming harder for the conventional politicians to carry on saying the same old thing if you have a new leader of the main opposition party saying something so different. It makes the standard politicians begin to look a bit stupid. So it's an interesting and very new development. Interestingly, just to end on that, that there is a connection between these two men in that Saunders' brother, Larry Saunders, actually stands for elections in Oxford, in my country.
Really?
So, he stood for the Green Party.
I did not know.
In my country. So we do have a connection. There is a connection between them. But people are beginning to realise, in larger and larger numbers, that what we have put up with in the 1980s and 90s and noughties has not worked. Letting a few people get rich doesn't reward amazing talent, which means that the amazing talent then goes on and does amazing things and creates you amazing banks and amazing businesses. It actually allows a few people to have the money go to their head and make amazingly bad mistakes, which is what they did. And so I think what you're seeing, in at least the case of the UK, where hundreds of thousands of people have joined political parties that are new, the Green Party and the Labour Party and UKIP, which is a right-wing party, slightly like your Tea Party. But again, it's a sign that people are angry with the traditional politics. People from all walks of life are not happy with what the main parties have been doing and saying, because they have been supporting rising inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And that rising inequality has not helped us. So I think there's an enormous scope for hope and to see things change. And in a way, it is a little bit like the last time this happened. In the 1920s and 30s, there was new political movements. There was a lot of anger. People were very upset. People didn't think things were getting better. They thought the rich were incredibly greedy. They had strikes. They fought for rights of women. And it was a hard slog. But in fact, in the 1920s and 30s, they did win an enormous amount. The rich did begin to worry. They did notice. And in the case of the UK, half of the equality we won between 1918 and 1979 was won by 1939, at a time when nobody thought they were making any progress and they didn't have the statistics that told them they were winning. They were just so angry with how badly behaved the rich had been before the 1929 banking crash.
So there's hope, you're saying. There's hope.
There's a lot of hope.
Okay.
And part of the anger is going to give us hope.
It is going to.
I think it could be changing now.
Yeah.